A 12-year-old boy stands crying in a Louisville police station, furious that someone stole his red Schwinn bicycle. "I'm gonna whoop whoever took it," he tells Officer Joe Martin. Martin, who moonlights as a boxing trainer, asks a simple question. "Do you know how to fight?" That stolen bicycle in 1954 set in motion one of history's most extraordinary transformations. From Cassius Clay, a kid who couldn't sit still in his stroller, to Muhammad Ali, the most recognizable face on earth. But this isn't just a rags-to-riches sports story. It's the biography of a man who refused to be what anyone wanted him to be, who traded his championship belt for his principles, and who ultimately proved that one person's courage could shake the world. Ali's family tree was stained with brutality. His great-grandfather was a slave, possibly fathered by Senator Henry Clay. His grandfather murdered a man over 25 cents and did prison time. His father was a violent alcoholic who once slashed his own son in a drunken rage. This wasn't the origin story anyone would choose, yet it forged something unbreakable in young Cassius Clay. From the moment he could stand, he refused to sit, literally standing in his stroller, walking at 10 months, insisting on feeding himself. He led neighborhood boys on adventures, ate his lunch on the way to school, and imitated police sirens to make drivers pull over. The question isn't whether Ali was great, it's how a boy born into violence and segregation became the embodiment of defiance, dignity, and hope for millions. Growing up in segregated Louisville, Cassius watched his mother return home exhausted from caring for white families, only to summon energy for her own children. He saw black workers earning half what whites did, relegated to dangerous jobs. Louisville practiced polite racism, but racism is never polite when you're on the receiving end. When his bicycle was stolen and Joe Martin invited him to the gym, Cassius found something more valuable, a path offering visibility, respect, and revolutionary equality with white boys. At Central High School, Cassius avoided team sports. Why share the spotlight? He shadowboxed between classes and signed autographs as Cassius Clay, World Heavyweight Champion, already inhabiting his envisioned future. He scored 83 on an IQ test and likely suffered from undiagnosed dyslexia. But what he lacked in reading comprehension, he compensated with visual genius, an ability to read opponents' movements that became his signature advantage. Between 12 and 18, Cassius fought roughly 100 amateur bouts, developing an unorthodox style, circling clockwise, punching and moving away, managing distance with supernatural precision. At 17, he shocked Chicago's Golden Gloves by defeating Tony Madigan, a 29-year-old Olympic veteran. Chicago offered national media exposure and his introduction to Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam. By the 1960 Rome Olympics, 18-year-old Clay won gold, returned to Louisville as a hero, and signed with 11 wealthy businessmen. He bought a pink Cadillac and began his professional career under Angelo Dundee in Miami, where his transformation from talented fighter to cultural phenomenon would accelerate beyond imagination. Clay's fame attracted a magnetic circle. Drew Bundini Brown Jr., a ghetto poet, coined "float like a butterfly, sting like a bee." More significant was Malcolm X, who met Clay in 1962 at a Detroit mosque, teaching him to question everyone's motives. This friendship terrified Clay's management as his title shot approached. Sonny Liston was a nightmare opponent, an ex-convict with mob connections who'd destroyed Floyd Patterson twice. Clay deliberately provoked him, mocking Liston as "that big, ugly bear." At the weigh-in, Clay wore a bear hunting jacket and lunged at Liston, screaming, "Somebody gonna die at ringside tonight." On February 25, 1964, Clay shocked the world, dominating Liston, who refused to answer the bell for the seventh round. The next morning, Clay declared, "I don't have to be what you want me to be," rejecting Christianity and integration. 6 days later, Elijah Muhammad announced Cassius Clay would become Muhammad Ali. His parents were furious, but Ali had found something more valuable than his birth name. He'd found his voice. In February 1966, Ali's draft reclassification made him eligible for Vietnam. His response became legendary. I don't have no quarrel with those Viet Congs. On April 28, 1967, he refused induction in Houston, accepting 50 years in prison for his beliefs. Within hours, boxing authorities stripped his title and license. An all-white jury convicted him in 20 minutes, 5 years prison, $10,000 fine. Though free on bail, his confiscated passport ended his career at its peak. As anti-war sentiment grew, Ollie's stance resonated powerfully. Julian Bond noted, "People who had never thought about the war, black and white, began to think it through because of Ollie." To survive, Ollie lectured at colleges, copying Elijah Muhammad's teachings onto index cards to overcome his reading struggles. Then came another blow. In March 1969, Elijah Muhammad banished Ollie from the nation for 1 year, revoking his Muslim name because he'd told Howard Cosell he wanted to fight again for money. Ollie had sacrificed his championship for principle. Now he'd lost his religious community too. Yet he never wavered. Don King secured $10 million from Zaire's dictator to stage Ollie Foreman in Kinshasa with a $5 million payday for each fighter. The symbolism of two black Americans fighting for the championship in Africa resonated powerfully with Ollie. Every expert predicted his destruction. George Foreman had demolished Joe Frazier and Ken Norton, the only men who'd beaten Ollie. Ollie cast Foreman as the establishment fighter, telling David Frost, "If he wins, we're slaves for 300 more years." Landing in Kinshasa to massive crowds, Ollie soon had them chanting, "Ollie Boma Ye, Ollie kill him." On October 30, 1974, Ollie shocked everyone by abandoning his signature dance and moving to the ropes, pugilistic suicide. Yet most of Foreman's punches missed or caught Ollie's arms. For 7 rounds, Ollie employed the rope-a-dope, absorbing Foreman's increasingly ineffective punches while taunting, "Is that all you got?" By the 8th round, Foreman was exhausted. Ollie unleashed a devastating combination. Foreman fell. Ollie became only the second heavyweight in history to lose and regain the championship. The 1975 Thrilla in Manila against Joe Frazier marked both a technological breakthrough, broadcast via satellite through HBO, and Ollie's most brutal fight. In oppressive heat, both men suffered tremendously. By the 14th round, Frazier could barely see, prompting his manager, Eddie Futch, to stop the fight. Ollie collapsed after raising his hand in victory. The next day, urinating blood and physically devastated, he asked, "Why I do this?" He declared he was finished. Within weeks, he changed his mind. The fans want to see it. His speech was noticeably slower. Despite his deterioration, Ollie kept fighting. In 1978, Leon Spinks defeated him. 6 months later, Ollie reclaimed the title, becoming the first three-time heavyweight champion. In 1980, Larry Holmes landed 340 punches to Ollie's 42 before the stoppage. Holmes, crying, embraced him. "I love you. I really respect you." Ollie's final fight came against Trevor Burbick in December 1981. At 236 pounds, showing none of his signature style, he lost by unanimous decision and whispered, "Father Time just got me." The most poignant moment came during the 1996 Atlanta Olympics. Despite his visibly shaking hand from Parkinson's syndrome, Ollie lit the Olympic cauldron to thunderous cheers, a rebel unafraid to show vulnerability. 5 months after Ollie's death in 2016, a story emerged from 1966. During Martin Luther King Jr.'s Chicago Freedom Movement, a family participating in a rent strike faced eviction. As their belongings were dumped onto the sidewalk, Muhammad Ali, then 24 and at his athletic peak, appeared unexpectedly. Without a word, he removed his coat, picked up a kitchen chair, and carried it back inside. The sheriff's deputies didn't stop him. Within seconds, dozens followed his lead, refilling the apartment. Ali simply drove away, an unrecorded moment of quiet activism from the people's champ. This story encapsulates Ali's enduring legacy. He transformed from a brash young boxer proclaiming, "I am the greatest," into a global humanitarian who proved you could be both. He refused the draft when serving would have been easier, sacrificing his championship and losing years of his athletic prime. As Parkinson's later slowed his speech, Ollie became something even more powerful, a symbol of human dignity and courage. As Ollie reflected, "I had to prove you could be a new kind of Black man." His life asks us, what are you willing to sacrifice for your principles? True greatness isn't measured in championships won, but in the courage to stand alone when it costs everything.